I was hoping one of our members would get here, but we'll go ahead and get started. I want to welcome everybody. Thank you for taking the time to come down today. Yeah. Okay.
Uh-oh.
Aha!
Can you borrow my hammer?
That is not good.
Tell me what technology by the
night. We got the cameras on that.
This would be great for the signing die tape. I hope they're filming it.
Hopefully they'll change that when we fix everything up around here.
I get 6 feet from all I can take.
Okay, we're on tape now. Call the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs to order. I want to thank everybody for coming down today and taking the time to be with us, and hopefully we'll get some work done. It's not working. Okay.
It's working.
Man.
Well, looks like we'll have to adjourn and come back tomorrow.
Are they doing it up there? Does that count?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Do you want to go get another tape? And
well, these are dual decks.
Okay. Okay. Right again. House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs called to order. And I'll welcome everybody once again. Keep it that short this time. Introduction of the committee. Representative Schaffler is here. Representative and co-chair is Representative Wayne Smith. Wayne Smith. Wayne Scott.
The other way.
How soon we forget. And Representative Boone. And the committee administrator is Bill Taylor.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering who that guy with the beard was.
Yeah, that's what threw me, I'll tell you.
Representative Smith.
We're going to tell you.
Mr. Taylor, you want to give us a little rundown, please?
Sure. For the agenda, you also have to adopt the rules, and the committee administrator is Patsy Wood, too.
I'm sorry.
You have the rules before you. These are summary rules that every committee has for the 74th Legislative Assembly, House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs rules. You have the agenda today. We start off at 10:15, 10:30. Reintegration program to assist small business owners returning from tours and active duty, often from Iraq and Afghanistan. This would basically apply to National Guard and reservists. The interesting thing about this is there's going to be a proposal for a legislative bill for the supplemental session. This committee will have to, in general terms, indicate its willingness to sponsor this bill and move forward with it. It will be a while, probably not until December, until Legislative Council's office will be able to draft the bill, because they are still doing editing and still working off the old template from the 2005 session. That should be complete by December. I would assume that we will have a draft sometime around Christmas time, and we'll mail it out to everyone at that time and any other interested parties relating to that. Then we go into suicides in Oregon among veterans. I do want to tell you that I contacted the Federal Veterans Administration, and they originally had people on the agenda, but I got a call from the Portland office and said they had checked with Washington, D.C., and they would not talk to the committee in a public meeting. And I told them all our meetings had to be under the Constitution, open to the public, and so we agreed that they would not be on the agenda. But they were scheduled to talk about this issue also. Then we're going to hear in the afternoon about post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. And then finally, we'll hear again about reintegration into the community. It's similar to what we're talking about at the beginning, but broader. The first part is narrow. It's mainly to help business people who go away, live their business for a year or two while they're in overseas, with a loan program or grant program that will help them restart their business.
Hey, thank you. Okay, the first order of business is adoption of the committee rules. Everybody has a copy there. Do I have a motion?
I move we adopt the rules, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffer moves we adopt the rules. Is there
second?
A second from Representative Scott or Smith?
Smith.
Any discussion? Will you call the roll, please?
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scott?
Aye.
Vice Chair Schaffler?
Aye.
Chair Bolquist? I mean, Barker?
Aye.
Nobody knows who anybody is.
Yeah, we'll show them excuse.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is the reintegration program to assist small business owners returning from tours of active duty, often in Iraq or Afghanistan. General Caldwell, Mr. Evans, and Ms. Brown, if you could come forward, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. I'm going to really turn this over to Mr. Evans from the Governor's Office and Paula Brown from OBVA, as they're the certified experts on this proposal, and appreciate your indulgence and see if we can't maybe move this thing along from previous discussions in the last session. Paul?
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Paul Evans. I'm a policy advisor on military and veterans affairs to Governor Kulongoski. And I'm going to try to keep the remarks also fairly brief, but what you have in front of you is a hopefully coherent explanation of what we're trying to do here. Last night I was modifying some things at 3 in the morning, so sometimes I'm not always that coherent. But the goal basically is to build on the work that you all have done over the last two sessions. In broad strokes, in terms of education and access to health care with TRICARE pluses and other things like that, the Veterans Committees of the Legislature have done a superb job. What we're now doing is picking up the little gaps. There's little pieces along the way that we've identified. And what was made pretty clear to everybody this summer as we were looking at the reintegration team and things following that discussion was that there is a small gap in service for small business owners that are veterans that go away for a year, 15 months, 18 months by the time they get back after being mobilized, trained, deployed, the sometimes month or 2 months of schooling and other things by the time they get back. And for those individuals that come back, they can come back to a small business that their customer base has found other sources. They come back, maybe some equipment wasn't repaired in a way that it should have been. They come back and there's bills that maybe haven't been paid or other types of challenges. So the theory was, if there's a way to provide state support for especially small business owners in small-scale loan or small-scale grants to help them get back up on their feet, that would be something that would not only be important as a signal that we take care of the Guard, but for those individuals affected in the communities that they're a part of, because often the small business folks are the ones that are also little league coaches and a lot of other things, if there's a way to help them, we want to. Now, in context, just proof in advertising, the federal government has two specific programs to help small business folks that are veterans. One ends 90 days after they get back, so it's really designed while you're gone, and not always do people know that or think about it when they're going. And the other piece is a $500,000 loan size, but it has a fairly, I would say, above, the interest that you pay is not the lowest you can get. And to some people, that could be a barrier. So what we looked at is there a way for, in the $20,000 or $40,000 category, a way for the state to help our veterans when they come back, be it National Guard folks or reservists, to help them get back up on their feet? Understand that that's the concept. The specifics that are before you are an attempt to explain that. Very flexible on how we do that, really. But this is the first approach we could get to. And what we're looking for is, if the committee sees fit, as this is one of the pieces you'd like to work on in the 08 session, that would be our hope.
Thank you. Ms. Brown?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today. For the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And to add just a little bit to what you've already heard from General Caldwell and Paul Evans, the department is very supportive of this concept. And I just wanted to give you a few, give you an idea of some agencies that are involved, that have talked about it, that are supportive, that are committed to working out details. details of such a program. And, of course, that's the Department of Veterans Affairs. We've had discussions with the Oregon Employment Department, Small Business Development Centers, Oregon Military Department, of course, Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, Economic and Community Development, Department of Labor, and Small Business Administration. So we've, in the important partnerships that we have as we're working on veterans issues, we've included all of those partners for the discussions to talk about, is there a need? How can we meet that need? And are we all on board? And how can we work as partners to make that happen? And some of the important things that came out of that, as Paul indicated, you know, there are some programs available, but there is still a gap after analyzing those programs and taking a look at potential things that the state might be able to do to fill that gap. And this is really a way that that gap can be filled. You know, we, as Paul indicated, we've looked at education, we've looked at employment, we've looked at all those different things, and this is still one of the gaps that we found, that we have these veterans being deployed, they come back, and they really just need a shot in the arm for their businesses, because those businesses have had some problems not having the attention and the commitment of that veteran, you know, being on site and able to work with that. And to keep my remarks brief, I think that, you know, that's about it. There would be some flexibility in this program that aren't offered in the other loans and grant programs that are available. So I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? I think this is an excellent proposal to come forward. as fewer and fewer Americans are truly doing the sacrificing in military matters, it's important that we take care of them, especially when we take people out of our communities, the reserves and the National Guard, send them overseas, and they do a great job. They have really set a fine example for the rest of the country, and to have them come back and be not caught up just seems like this would be a good way just to help them get their foot back on the ladder. And I really appreciate you bringing this idea forward.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess you have triggered my brain here. Do we, you have any data on the impact of the economy of these businesses having trouble with the negative impact on this state's economy due to these businesses having trouble?
Mr. Right. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, we don't have any. We have some anecdotal data. Mm-hmm. I can think of one young officer who went with the 2162 into Iraq. He was a one-man show marketing company. His wife worked out. He left. Nobody to run his business because his wife had a full-time job. And all of his clients dissipated into other folks. He came back and basically was at square one again. Mm-hmm. He ultimately ended up closing that business down. In fact, there was an article on him in the Portland Business Weekly or Journal, I think it was. And he's, you know, rebounded, ended up hooked up with somebody else in another company, and he's doing what he likes to do. But in fact, the business failed because he couldn't, the transition between active duty and the time it took for him to earn money, that 6-8 month period that he knew it was going to take to regenerate that business, he said, I've got to go to work. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't regenerate his other business. Now, that's anecdotal. I couldn't tell you.
No, I understand.
We don't think there's a lot. We think there's a handful of folks. And typically these folks are, as Mr. Evans indicated, these are your high performers. These are the folks that are out there that really, really got something on the ball, both for us and for the community. They're not deadbeats.
Right.
And you don't see those kind of folks in any kind of a business. So.
Thank you. I just want to say the noise you're hearing, there's a lot of construction going on in the building. They're trying to keep it quiet underneath us today. But
I thought it was the brass band that I had out in the hall. For my presentation. But
okay, Mr. S.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, just kind of an add-on to what the General said, it might be a little harder to find specific data on this because a lot of the folks that we're talking about aren't the folks that are going to be complaining. They'll just pick up and move on. But we know there's a value there, and we know that, exactly as the chair said, that if there's a way to make sure that the folks that are sacrificing, contributing, maybe they're not advantaged, but at least they're not disadvantaged by that service. That's the real goal.
And, Mr. Chair, just for the record, I'm complete supporter of this as well. if there's just a few folks out there who need our help, we need to help them out after what they've done. After what they've done for this country. So thank you for bringing it up.
And I think we all recognize, too, how important small business is to the Oregon economy. I know Representative Scott has a real personal knowledge about growing from a small business and really developing, keeping on, more people are working because of entrepreneurs like him. So, okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, before you move on, though, I have one other thing I'd like you to mark your calendars on in reference to what we're doing. And if you don't mind me taking just a second, on the 29th of this month, next week, I guess it is, next Monday, there's a Veterans Summit World Trade Center where the city of Portland is pulling together all of the local businesses in the Portland metro area for a summit to discuss some of these same issues that you're talking about, where they can help. And then again on November 3rd at Clackamas Community College, they have offered to put on a job reintegration fair, and that's for all veterans, and it should have a good example of what I think our communities are doing in support of all veterans. And we're anticipating somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 people at that event at Clackamas Community College. So if you would, mark your calendars, and if you have any interest in that, please join us, and that'll be interesting.
I'll be on a long flight that day on the 3rd. So.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry, I do have one additional comment. I would be remiss if I didn't include in my list of partners the veterans organizations that we've been working with, and they've come forward. United Veterans Groups of Oregon consists of the congressionally chartered veterans organizations in Oregon and other additional veterans organizations, and they've been full support of such a program to help those National Guard and Reserve veterans who are coming back. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Your next item.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that when last session, when we did some of our bills in our package as well, they were seemingly small things, but just like this is a little gap here, is anything we can do to help integrate things when they get back is best. I attended a stand-down at Camp Rialia, which is all kind of a one-stop shopping for all the services available, and this will be great to add to next year's stand-down when they have that in the summer. I assume it'll be in the summer again.
Okay. I'd entertain a motion to have Mr. Taylor start preparing a draft on this particular issue. We'll have to have another meeting probably after the first of the year, and it's my goal to see if we can't get this in the supplemental session in February.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have a motion from Representative Schaffler.
Second.
And a second from Representative Boone.
Second.
Is there any discussion?
Can you go into a work session to do that?
Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll do that. I'll back up. We'll close the hearing and open a work session on the proposal. Just the small business owners returning from Iraq.
So moved, Mr. Chair. If that's all.
Representative Schaffler moves that we ask or direct Mr. Taylor to draft a bill that will kind of flesh out in January, probably. I have a motion. I have a second.
Oh, second.
Mr. Chair, do we need a second? I don't think we need a second.
Okay, well, call the roll.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scott?
Aye.
Vice Chair Schaffler?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Okay, thank you. The next item on the agenda is suicide among Oregon veterans, and they have scheduled Mr. Cohn and Ms. Millett.
Dr. Cohn, is your son still on the jazz band with Mr. Hatton?
Chair Barker, Representative Schaffler, yes, he is.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, great.
Thank you for asking.
My pleasure. Just for disclosure, Mr. Chair, my daughter and the doctor's son are on a little jazz band that their music teacher put together.
I understand she has a fine clarinet.
She does. We got a good deal on it. For those out there listening, I purchased the clarinet from Representative Barker, tonight's old woodwind. My daughter plays it like Benny Goodman.
Is it your high school clan?
No, it's my daughter's.
So your daughter's
concert partner.
Oh, my goodness.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division at the Department of Human Services. And with me is Lisa Miette, who is the manager of our injury prevention and epidemiology program in my office. And we are going to be talking with you about the issue of suicide in veterans. I apologize, the color appears a little bit hard to read here. Doesn't look quite that way on my screen, but you do have hard copies of my presentation, so
this is just terrible.
We'll move on. Oh, my. Okay. This is a serious topic, and one that is a distressing one for all of us to talk about. And I think, in a way, the fact that it's so serious and depressing gets in the way often of us looking at this in a clear and analytic way and trying to figure out what we can do to prevent these deaths. You may be wondering what I'm doing here as a public health practitioner talking about this, and I hope through the course of my presentation you'll see that this is an enormous public health problem, and I say public health because it has aspects of it that are definitely within the mental health realm, but aspects of it that also have to do with the community and with attitudes and access to treatment and so forth, the kinds of issues that typically do fall in the public health realm. So that's how we got engaged with this, in partnership with a variety of people, including, you already heard from General Caldwell and some of his team, there are many other partners as well that I'll be talking about. So what I'm going to do is I want to talk a little bit about the epidemiology of suicide and some of the ideas behind suicide prevention, some of the models that we use when we think about this, and then I'll talk with you more specifically about the issue for veterans. Unfortunately, I wish I had more information. I think the information I'm going to present to you is going to raise more questions than it's going to answer about the problem in veterans, but we'll talk some more about that when we get there. Okay. In 2005, we had over 550 deaths in Oregon from suicide. That's over 10 deaths each week. I think most people don't realize that suicide is a very common cause of death here. It's the 7th ranking cause of death for men, the 12th ranking cause of death for women. And while the rates are a little higher in the western U.S. and in Oregon in general, for the country as a whole, suicide is one of the leading causes of death. We have more deaths from suicide each year here in Oregon than we do from traffic crashes, where we have about 400 to 450 deaths each year. So this is a big problem and largely an unrecognized one. This graph, again, I apologize for the difficulty reading it. The large bar on your left shows you the rate of suicides per 100,000 population in Oregon, and the small bar on your right shows you the rate of homicides. I like to make this comparison because, again, think about the effort we put into preventing homicides and all of the law enforcement effort and so forth. And I think suicide, by comparison, is relatively under-resourced and less focused on as a problem. Whenever I talk about suicide, I do have to give a little bit of a disclaimer about the physician-assisted suicide issue. This refers to deaths under the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. Under that law, it explicitly says these deaths are not classified as suicide, so they're not included in any of the data that I'm going to talk to you about, and I'm really not going to focus on those issues at all today. Okay. This graph shows the rate of suicide by age group, and the two bars for each age group represent males and females, males on the left and females on the right, and you can see that the bars on the left are higher for every age group. This is largely a male problem, and it's also something that increases dramatically with age, and the rates are really quite huge once you get beyond age 65. The fact that it's a male problem, of course, since most veterans are male, means that this is an issue that's going to affect them particularly. In terms of race and ethnicity, the rates are highest among whites, but there are still substantial problems in other ethnic groups as well, particularly blacks, Asians, and Hispanics. When we talk about suicide and we classify deaths, we classify them according to the manner of death, which would be homicide, suicide, or an unintentional death. And we separate that from the mechanism or cause of death. So, for example, you could have a suicide by a firearm. You could have a homicide by a firearm. You could have an unintentional death by a firearm, the firearm being the mechanism of death. So what you can see from this graph, the largest piece of the pie, which is about 60% of the suicides that we see in Oregon, are firearm suicides.
Sure.
Hey,
voila.
Love that.
If we only had a 10-year-old, we could have.
Poisoning also is a serious problem and a major contributor to suicide deaths as well. And probably in this area, the number of suicides is probably particularly underestimated, because often with poisonings, it's difficult to determine what the intent was of the person who took the medication. But in general, the medical examiner is pretty conservative in classifying deaths as suicide because of the stigma and implications of that for people. And so if there's a doubt, it would either be listed as an undetermined death or classified as an unintentional death, unless there was some clear evidence that this was a suicide. Now, suicide occurs in different patterns in different age groups and other subgroups of the population. What this graphic demonstrates is that the deaths are kind of the tip of the iceberg. Those are at the top, as you can see, in the left-hand triangle anyway. Then we have hospitalizations in green, and then suicidal ideation, people who say that they're thinking about killing themselves. And you can see that for youth, which is what the left-hand pyramid indicates, we have relatively few deaths compared to the number of hospitalizations and ideation. I mean, 15% of youth tell us on our youth survey that they have seriously considered suicide at some point. I can't remember the time period that's included. It's either the last year. Okay. So suicidal ideation among youth is very common, yet relatively few youth die from suicide. Still too many. 70 is clearly still too many. Each one of those is a tragedy. The situation for the elderly, and as you remember in the graph that I showed you with the rates by age, the rates are highest in the elderly. The situation is flipped for the elderly, where relatively more of those result in death. There's only 1% who report some kind of suicidal ideation, and only 60 hospitalizations. So I think that says something about the kinds of prevention efforts that we need for these two different groups. They really need to be targeted a little bit differently. And certainly within the spectrum of the veterans population, we do have folks in both of those age groups and everything in between, obviously, as well. Okay. So that's a little background for you on what we know about the epidemiology of suicide. And by the way, just to put in the plug for the public health approach to this, this really is kind of a classic public health approach to a problem, is to first collect some data and look at the problem and see what that tells us. But, you know, I think we often need to understand what makes someone suicidal. What are the risk factors or issues that lead someone to try to kill themselves or to, in fact, kill themselves? Thomas Joyner is a psychologist at the University of Florida, and he has presented this theory of suicide. He says you need to have three necessary precursors. First is the acquired capability to enact lethal self-injury. And the idea there is that it's not biologically normal for any of us to want to kill ourselves, right? The innate biological drive is to reproduce and live. And so this capability to actually hurt yourself is something that is acquired, and there's often kind of a rehearsal element to it. And we know that the strongest predictive factor for people dying by suicide is having attempted a suicide before. And that kind of backs up this idea that as you get used to the pain, perhaps, as you get used to this idea of hurting yourself, that it becomes easier to push it to the brink and actually kill yourself. The second has to do with some of the community issues that are related to this, the sense that one is a burden on loved ones. Obviously, a lot of that is inside someone's mind and the way they perceive themselves, but a lot of that has to do with what kinds of messages they're getting from those around them in the community also. And number three, the sense that one doesn't belong to or is not connected with a valued group or relationship. So this is one way of thinking about why someone becomes suicidal. And I think it starts to take us down the road, but it's useful to kind of make some of the other factors here very explicit as well. And this is kind of a busy slide, but the idea here is that we have an individual all the way over in the far right, and they're embedded in some kind of relationships with people in a community. They exist in institutions as well and in society as a whole. And so, in fact, there are issues at every one of these levels that affect the decisions that that person ultimately makes about whether to consider suicide or actually attempt or kill themselves. So some of the individual level risk factors, and I think this is where we tend to think about this problem as being located. Clearly, depression is a major factor, hopelessness, withdrawal. You can see some of the things you can imagine in different age groups. For example, poor physical health for the very elderly is a very, very big deal, generally less so for the youth who are attempting suicide. But these are very, very important individual level risk factors. But there are also some individual protective factors as well. We often cast this in a negative light, but there are a lot of things out there that prevent people from going down this path as well. What kind of coping skills do they have for the adversities that they're confronting? Engagement and treatment for some of the behavioral health problems like depression, existential and spiritual well-being, a lot of good data to support that as being important here, and belief that one can resolve problems and survive difficult periods. So if we're going to address this problem, there probably are some ways we can bolster some of these influences. At the relationship level, again, social isolation is a very potent risk factor, particularly with age. Family discord, bereavement, particularly in the first year after death, and family members' attitudes about behavioral health care probably influence whether or not you get into treatment for your depression and or stay in it once you get in it. At the community level, some of these relationship factors translate into community level issues. What kinds of social connectedness do we have? It's fine that your family is supportive of you being in behavioral health care, but if there's nobody for you to go to see or you can't get in to see them, that's a serious problem. Whether or not there are gaps in healthcare providers here, I noted particularly providing care to seniors, but this occurs across the age span, religious institutions, and perceptions of safety as well. And then at the society level, some of our underlying beliefs, for example, that it's inevitable that the elderly should feel suicidal, it's automatically a depressing thing, prejudice or discrimination against the elderly, and the stigma about behavioral health problems and about going for care. Another way to present this same idea is to think about this as a wall of protection. You can see some of the things on the wall there. And if you knock out a few of those bricks, the bigger that hole becomes, the easier it is for somebody to fall through. So there isn't one single key to this. It's really a network of factors that need to be addressed. And that's, I think, a key point to keep in mind as you think about this problem, that there's no single intervention that's going to fix this, that it needs to be addressed in a multiple ways, in addition to the provision of individual mental health care, and no doubt that's very, very important, but all of these community risk factors and protective factors are very important too. So we need a multifaceted approach where all of these pieces are complementary. Sometimes I think it's hard for people to conceptualize what we mean by some of the community level interventions. This is one that I'm particularly fond of because it just seems so simple. So I just want to share this with you. This is a paper that comes out of the Veneto region of northern Italy. I keep suggesting that I be sent there to do some field research on this, but it hasn't quite happened yet. This is a program that's focused on the elderly. Older adults are referred by general practitioners or social workers because of some problem that they're having. It's not terribly tightly defined, either disability, concerns about social isolation, psychiatric problems, or some other risk factors. And what they're given is a phone call twice a week. They're also given one of those alarms that you hang around your neck and you can press if you fall or are incapacitated in some way. And they're also given a phone number that they can call if they want to reach out to somebody and get help. They often tend not to call, but just having the number is a very important psychological factor. So in the study that evaluated this, they looked at almost 19,000 clients who had been referred to this, and I think had some pretty dramatic results. Based on past history, they would have expected six of these folks to die by suicide. And they would have expected 21 of these folks to die by suicide, but in fact, only six of them did. And that's a 69% reduction. This is not a terribly complicated intervention. Just calling people on the phone and letting them know that they're not out there alone is essentially the crux of it. The effect was more pronounced for women than for men. And there were other health benefits as well. There were decreased requests for home visits, decreased hospitalization, and decreased depression. So this is an example of a community-level kind of intervention that I think can have an impact on these kinds of problems. I do want to say a little bit. Now I'm going to switch to the veterans piece for you and present the data that we have. The data that we do have come from our death certificates and also from something called the Oregon Violent Death Reporting System. This is a federally funded system that currently is in 14 states. There are plans for it to be nationwide ultimately, and I just heard this week actually that Senator Gordon Smith has sponsored an appropriations amendment that will increase the funding for this system and allow 8 to 12 more states to come on board. It's still in conference and hopefully is going to survive that conference, but he's been a very strong supporter of this system. We were one of the first states funded in 2003, and what we do is we take the death certificate data and then we include with that data from the medical examiner, from the crime lab, and also from law enforcement when those data are available. So here's what the data showed us about veterans. What you see are veterans in blue and non-veterans in orange, and the suicide rates by age group. And you can see that there's a huge difference in the 18 to 24-year-olds, but also in many other age groups. The red star indicates a statistically significant difference. So we were pretty impressed when we saw this, and actually we just published these data this year because we finally had enough data that we could do this. Since we've been doing this since 2003, it takes a few years for the data to accumulate in sufficient numbers that we felt we could speak confidently about this. Of course, this raises lots of questions, the first one being, why? And I'm sure you're asking that question as well. We don't have a lot of those answers right now. Some of the questions that were raised in our minds, people who choose to go into the military at baseline before they go in are different from people who don't. Are some of those differences, could they explain some of this? Is there something that happened during whatever their service was, and we have no information yet on service? I would presume, for example, that the 18 to 24-year-olds were largely serving in the Iraq theater, whereas those in the 75 and above age group were probably World War II vets or Korean War or maybe Vietnam. What happened during their service experience that might relate to this? We haven't yet been able to make that linkage.
Thank you. Dr. D, okay, the 18 to 24, 2000 to 2005, do you have data from those same age groups that overlap the Vietnam era war, Korean World War II, and are these numbers different or are they similar to those war eras at the time.
When they were 18 years.
Yeah, the 1824s from, you know, 1945 to 1950. Do you have data to overlap that? And is it the same, or is this different?
Representative Barker, Representative Shoffler, we don't have those data yet. We're going to be able, I think, to look at some of that in a limited way on our death certificates. But our violent death reporting system is so new that we don't have all of the data from all of those other sources. I think that's an excellent way to approach this. It's a very epidemiological way to approach this. I like that way of thinking about this, because it asks the question, has something changed, or is this some characteristic about that particular age group? I don't know, Lisa, did you have anything you wanted to add on that issue? Okay. There certainly are lots of other factors that could be interacting here as well, and I think this bears some further looking into.
Excuse me, a question from Representative Scott.
Yes.
So doing a quick math on that, I come up with that there was like round figures, approximately 450, based upon your graphs and kind of interpolating what the numbers might be in a 5-year period. Am I correct on that?
No.
Yeah, I don't care if you agree that I'm correct on the number, but the purple indicates approximate numbers in each age group over a 5-year period of time, right?
Representative Barker, Vice Chair Scott, it's actually a rate. It's not a number. So what goes in the numerator of that rate is the number of deaths, and in the denominator goes the number of people in that age group.
So if that's the case, looking ahead in the next presenter's information, there were 153 in 2005 veterans that committed suicide. Could you get us the information on what the numbers were in each of the 5 years, 2000 to 2005?
Chair Barker, Representative Scott, yes. I don't have those off the top of my head.
I also would like to request the same information based upon what Representative Shoffler said back to the same type of thing back into the mature cycle of the Vietnam era.
If you could get that information to the administrator, to Mr. Taylor, he'll get it distributed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So some of the other issues, you know, is this a result of post-traumatic stress disorder? I know there's been a lot of information out about high levels of brain injury in the Iraq theater. Does that somehow play into this? Other physical problems, lots of issues with readjustment to civilian life. Again, the situation, because of the mix of different branches of the armed forces this time around, may change some of that. Strong value of self-reliance. This is an important part of military culture, and it's a good thing that our soldiers, you know, see that they need to get the job done at whatever cost. But that may make it difficult to reach out for help when that's indicated. The stigma I've already talked about, and the honor is a very strong value, again, for the military. Again, does that have something to do with this? The accessibility and familiarity with guns, these are guys who have been in theater of war, are obviously very comfortable around that. Does that play a role in this in some way or not? And then the lack of access to mental health care. Again, these are all questions. I don't have data to answer these for you, but some of the issues that they've raised for us.
Oh, excuse me.
Well, it just occurred to me that maybe, because you're talking about 18 to 24 years, that's pretty young, and in a lot of cases, some of these people might be coming just from out of home and school in a pretty protected element, and not having been exposed to seeing violent death or injury, and unless they live in the country and maybe see it in animals, or they work on a volunteer fire department, etc., you know, they just haven't been exposed to these absolutely right out in front of you blood, gore, and guts, you know. And it's, I think that's hard on people who first see it. And, you know, and the, just the fact that they're so young, they don't have the years, and looking at guys who've been in the military for a while and have served several tours might have more of a, you know, they've seen it, they've however they learn to deal with it and go on with the job, it may make a difference. I don't know. I'm guessing. I don't know if there's something we could do. You know, there's the military sitting here to help prepare. I don't know what your prep process is, so, but it's just a thought.
Chair Barker, Representative Boone, I think that's an interesting hypothesis, and again, with some more data, maybe we could shed some light on that, I think.
Yes.
Do you have data for requests for services, mental health, or support of some kind in these demographics relative to the civilian demographic? For example, the 1824 that aren't in the military, and what they're asking for, requesting for, seeking, and what's not available to them, and then the same questions for the 1824 from the folks that are coming back from the military, specifically combat folks. And is there a difference between those that are in the military that don't go to combat, and those there must be, and those that are in that do go to combat? I imagine. Do you have a comparison for those, or is it similar? Is it much higher for those combat veterans? I would guess the question I would say would be yes, but you have all that?
Chair Barker, Representative Shuffler, no, we don't. We don't have any information on where these folks served. As you say, if they were sitting behind a desk, their experience was surely very different than being in a place where there was active combat going on and what they would have seen and been exposed to and so forth. And I think, one of the things that we're hoping to do is to identify some of those data resources with our partners on the military side and link them with the death information that we have so that we can hopefully shed some more light on some of these questions. I have a preventive medicine resident who's expressed some interest in doing this with us, and I'm hoping that that's gonna work out. I don't have those data to present to you today, but I think it's a really important question to be asking. Some of the other things that we've done, we did speak with the county mental health providers and their crisis intervention teams. Every county mental health provider does have a crisis intervention team to let them know about our findings that veterans are at increased risk, and also let them know about the availability of the reintegration team that General Caldwell spoke about. I know you've heard about that a little bit, and I believe you have that on your agenda for this afternoon to talk some more about that. I think that's a terrific resource to help address some of these concerns. For the National Guard, we have provided some suicide prevention training to the reintegration team members and also the family support network members about some of the epidemiology of this, some of the ways that they might approach this with people. How do you ask the right questions in a way that's sensitive and going to elicit the answers? And then what do you do if somebody says that there is a problem? Similarly, there is a very effective suicide prevention program that the U.S. Air Force has put in place, and that has dramatically reduced their rates of suicide. Clearly, that's a program that probably would work very well in other military settings. So we have provided some materials from that program. And then we do have a program in the state that's funded with the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Act funds to undertake youth suicide prevention programs in three parts of the state, Northeast Oregon, Southwest Oregon, and Lane County. And so we think that some of the skills and issues overlap with the needs here, and so we've tried to connect these two groups of people up so that hopefully they can learn from each other and help each other. At the Veterans Administration Hospital in Portland, we have provided some training on suicide prevention there, and they have at the federal level, they have stepped up and hired a large group of suicide prevention coordinators across the country, and we have encouraged the linkage between the folks who have been hired here in Portland and our other local resources. And then finally, we have done a little bit of promotion of a recently passed bill that provides a physician tax incentive for provision of health care to veterans, mental health care being a piece of that. We've tried to get that information out to the physician community with whom, obviously, as the health department, we communicate with a great deal. So I think those are the primary things I wanted to say today. I'm happy to answer further questions or participate in any other discussion. And I know.
Lisa, did you have anything?
Just a quick question, too. Is there any effort to test your data as to whether things are different in the rural areas, and including access to the, some of the health care and mental health care. And seeing that you're doing that promotion of the new bill for the tax incentive, is that enough to encourage people in the outer lands to sign on to this, or is it do we need to do more to encourage people to go out there and be available, kind of like the rural docs program where they forgive loans, et cetera, for serving in the rural areas?
Chair Barker, Representative Boone, I don't know the answer to your second question as to whether that's enough. This is a fairly new program. It certainly bears some evaluation, to be sure. We haven't broken out these data by rural and urban, but I think if you were to ask our staff, our belief would be that probably access to these healthcare resources is more difficult in rural areas. It's more of a challenge. And that's partly because of fewer providers, and also because the distances are bigger. It's just another obstacle for people to get there.
And that, I'm leading you onto that same tenet, that we have, in my district, one of the most common, it's not a complaint, it's just a comment. I get these calls and saying, if we just had another van, we'd be happy to go into Portland, or if we just had another driver. You know, it seems like it's a little fix, that kind of thing, and I don't know who all controls those numbers, because we could probably quadruple the number of people we would send inland, you know, if we had the capacity, the transportation, we've got the capacity to go in. It's not necessarily saying that they would have to be treated in that rural area, but just an access to it.
Representative,
yeah, this really does get your mind going, this whole subject matter. It's not that easy to talk about, but, you know, in light of the history, and I agree with Representative Scott, I would like to see Vietnam era, and I'd like to see World War II era, the GI Bill, and as much as I'd like to place the blame on this current administration, it's not all their fault. It has been slowly eroded over the decades. In World War II, this country provided some real tangible benefits to veterans, education and housing specifically, among others, I'd imagine, but real tangible financial help. Here, we're going to help you get a college education. We're going to pay for it. We're going to secure you a low interest loan for your family and your home, for a home. These are tangible. Yet today we aren't doing that to that degree. Yet we do have all these social things that, if people are willing to step up and ask for it, is available. Now, my mother suffers from mental health problems, and so does my brother, who's a Marine Corps veteran. And I can promise you, people suffering from mental illness do not seek out help. They don't. Now, if people do seek out financial help, though, because they got to have a place to live, and they do want to have an education. So I just love to see the comparisons between when we had a healthy GI Bill providing these real tangible benefits to people. Well, and maybe it won't make any difference. Maybe it's the same, regardless. But I would really like to see the differences, if there are any differences, because I think, I just would like to hypothesize here, that if we do provide people with opportunities, especially today, you get a young man or woman that's out of the military today going to college. I've been on campus. There are all kinds of things out there. Here are services provided to you. And maybe some of them will say, you know, I could use some help while they're there, and at the same time get a great education. So I guess that's my speech for reintroducing a stronger, tangible benefit in a GI Bill, which this country is not doing, unfortunately. And I would love to blame it on the current administration, but it's Republicans and Democrats that have allowed this to erode, and it's criminal, especially in light of the sacrifice we ask these men and women and their families to provide this country. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging me.
So, Representative Shelton, what are the benefits differential in the current administration versus what the administration in 1970 or 69 were?
I don't know the answer to that.
You're insinuating that they're different today based upon the administration.
I don't know the answer, but I do believe, if I'm not wrong, that the tangible benefits, getting a college education, it was paid for, if I'm not wrong, and the ability to
secure loan for a house was better, easier, and more tangibly beneficial to the veteran. Out of World War II, for example. I do not know the answer. As I said, I'm not an expert on the GI Bill.
I think that's correct. In Oregon, at least. Right.
They had a better education program, probably.
I don't know if they had a better education program. The cost of education may have been less.
Well, that's true. I believe that.
But I was as a point of interest, I got out of the military discharged in 1964, and I was able to get a 4% loan. And shortly after I got out, they started the GI Bill, which hadn't been in effect for some time. But it was, in those days, even being married, I think I got $150 a month. But it did help. Thank you.
I got out in 69.
Well, you're just a kid.
And can say different things about the benefits that were available.
But yeah, they were. And I'm just going to say, in Portland, I'm a retired Portland police lieutenant. We had a program for seniors that didn't discriminate between veterans or not, but they have a program where they call people once a week, and mainly just to make them feel a little safer and so on, and that seemed to be very helpful. And one other thing I would say, when I was a new officer, we'd have people involved in police shootings, and it would shoot somebody. And usually within 5 years they'd be done. They'd be either off on a disability of some sort. In those days we didn't know what PTSD was, so it was a bad back. And we would lose those people. And then they made available, you could go see somebody if you wanted to. Well, people wouldn't go because they didn't. I'm tougher than that. So since then, they made it mandatory. If you're involved in a shooting, you have to go see somebody before you come back to work. And then everybody goes and they get the help they need instead of being able to pretend like they're, or maybe they believe it at the time that they're too tough to deal with it. But anyway, some of those programs, I've seen some, what I think was good success within the narrow police family, but I think that would apply here. And police suicides, there's kind of this thing that they commit suicide more than other people, and that isn't the case. One time I looked into that, but what is the case is somebody in that line of work is more likely, if they commit suicide, to kill somebody else at the same time, which is... most unfortunate. Okay, well, thank you.
I had a question about the Italian program. And were these people who were in the program people without family and friends identified as maybe isolated? Or did they also have people who did have family and friends? Or do you know?
Chair Barker, Representative Boone, being socially isolated was not a requirement to get into the program, but a lot of the folks were socially isolated. So
it seems like that's a really inexpensive, easy to implement type program, even with volunteers.
Chair Barker, I wanted to respond a little bit to the discussion about veterans' benefits, because I think that the work that the reintegration team is doing for the Guard is a really, really important answer to some pieces of this. I mean, if you think about what happens to a National Guard member while they're in Iraq, for example, they're in a place where, obviously, it's the military, their day is very regimented, somebody's telling them what to do. They're in harm's way, of course, but they're surrounded by their buddies. It's in a way kind of a protective cocoon. And if you think about that wall of protection, it provides many pieces of that wall. Then they get demobilized. They come back. They're often, alone in their communities. They're not in that same kind of cocoon, if you will, and all of the other social issues that you all have spoken to come into play. And I think that's one of the things when we heard about the work that General Caldwell and his team were doing around this, we were really impressed, because I think it tries to provide some sense of support and connection and make those connections with these other services that I think can really make a difference in the lives of these guys.
And your reintegration program is being looked at from around the country with other arguments, because they're doing such a great job here. So we're pretty happy with that.
Okay. Perfect.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You. Thank you. Good work.
Thank you. Now you know about that little button on the side. I need to see which one it was.
Right after the meeting.
If they're ready.
Okay. Yeah, I think as well as you.
Oh, okay. So, thank you. We'll go ahead. We're a little ahead of schedule, but we'll go to the post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. Ms. Brown and Colonel Brown. We got ahead of schedule because we had planned for the federal VA people to be here, and they weren't able to.
He's not here yet. Go
ahead. Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. The handouts that you're receiving are an executive summary of a Veterans Disability Benefits Commission report, and you'll be happy to know that the executive summary will spare you reading several hundred pages, but of course that is available to you on the website, and you can certainly go there and take a look at that. Congress created the commission as a result of some concerns about a number of issues related to veterans benefits, including how long it took to process claims, taking a look at post-traumatic stress syndrome, and a number of other issues. Oregon was very fortunate that we had somebody from Oregon serving on that commission, and that's Colonel Larry Brown. And I just want to share a couple things with you that he may not. As a retired colonel, he brought to that commission some life experience, military experience, that I believe contributed greatly to that commission's very thoughtful discussions over the course of several months, and then some sound recommendations they came out with. And that certainly included his having been the recipient of a Silver Star, Bronze Star, Legion of Merit, Distinguished Flying Cross, Purple Heart, and many other awards. And so we're very fortunate to have with us Colonel Larry Brown, who served on the commission, represented Oregon, and I think we could be very proud of his involvement in that commission. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Colonel Larry Brown.
Thank you. Welcome, Colonel Brown.
Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to speak here. The Veterans Commission, Disability Commission, was created by Public Law 108-136, which was passed in 2004. We actually came together in 2005, and we ended October of this year. We spent basically 30 months in this study, an in-depth study. We were asked to look at the appropriateness of benefits. We were asked to look at the level of benefits and the appropriate standard of determining whether a benefit for disability or death for a veteran and how it was to be compensated. The commission was composed of 13 members appointed by president and also by the four leaders of Congress, five by the president and two each by each of the leaders of Congress. For almost 2.5 years, the commission conducted an extensive, comprehensive examination of issues related to veterans' disability benefits. This is the first time the commission or these benefits were looked at by an outside entity since 1956 under the Bradley Commission. We identified 31 issues for study and made an effort to ensure that all the analysis was evidence-based and data-driven. The Institute of Medicine, IOM, and the Center of Naval Analysis Corporation, CNAC, also were used in our evaluations. We examined many issues with added emphasis on quality of life, the veteran's rating schedule, post-traumatic stress syndrome, individual unemployment employability, presumptions, transition, which is critical, I think you will see, to our veterans, especially guardsmen, the concurrent receipt, capability and electronic data processing and claims processing. In addition, we will cover some of these. I've been asked to talk about PTSD and traumatic brain. We offered 113 recommendations on a wide spectrum of veterans' disability benefits issued and ensure that the benefits are uniformly compensated for all services. Some of the recommendations that we made are expensive. Some are not. Some can be adopted by VA and DOD. Others are going to require DOL, Department of Labor, and Social Security. Others will require legislation. The Commission understands that not all recommendations can be immediately used. We identified 14 recommendations in our judgment that are a higher priority. We're not saying that those 14 are any more important than the others of the 113 we made, but these are ones that we recommended initially to Congress that we should, if anything, look at first. You have asked me to talk about PTSD and traumatic brain. The VA system today currently uses what is called the GAF or GAF scoring to identify PTSD. This is a general type of scoring. It lumps all mental conditions into one type of scoring category, which makes it very difficult to identify PTSD as opposed to any other mental issues. We believed on the commission that there needed to be a holistic approach to PTSD, and it should establish compensation, treatment, and vocational assessment for those that identified under PTSD. One of the problems under PTSD today is what is called individual unemployability. The problem with PTSD assessments, we all know that there are people with certain mental issues but are still capable of performing in the social environment or work environment with either medication or counseling, an ongoing issue. But because of the GAF scoring system that is currently used by the VA, the only way an individual would receive 100% disability for PTSD is either they are locked up or they have to be individually unemployable. That means an individual that receives 100% due to individual unemployability cannot work by law. They are not allowed to go back into the workplace, and that puts an undue burden on both the system and the individual. We felt, and also through IOM's study, that that needs to be changed. There needs to be a different approach on how the scoring and how the people are evaluated. Both studies have shown that there has been a marked increase of individual unemployability due to PTSD. Some of that's due to an aging population out of the Vietnam era veteran. PTSD, as you're well aware, was not identified until late after the Vietnam era. We call that either during World War II and World War I, we call those, put those under different issues, shell shock, different types of things. An individual to suffer PTSD does not have to be in combat necessarily. Police officer in a shooting, somebody in a severe traffic accident can suffer PTSD. So it is not an issue only related to military environment. But we feel that there are certain criteria within the PTSD that need to be addressed by re-evaluating and using a more modern approach. We can better serve our veterans by identifying early on problems that they have. We feel through the commission and through the Institute of Medicine that an early intervention with individuals in the PTSD issue can be served better. We can probably recover many of these people. PTSD is treatable. It is not necessarily something that can be cured. It will reoccur, it will remit, And but through treatment, mainly the treatment that they're finding now is basically treatment through group therapy or individual therapy. Medication has not necessarily been the answer. It is an approach, but they're finding that that is not necessarily the issue. Traumatic brain has come into the event, and only recently has traumatic brain become an issue or an identified symptom coming out of this current war. The two signature war injuries coming out of the current conflict is PTSD and traumatic brain injury. During the Vietnam era, probably during World War II and World War I, we called those type of injuries closed head injuries. They were looked at as strictly concussion and nothing more than that. We are finding today that we are identifying young men and women as PTSD individuals when they are truly traumatic brain injuries. It is a new era in medicine and has to have a new approach to it. Currently, the approach to solving these, both traumatic brain and PTSD, are treatable. There are some very good clinics being adopted and set up throughout the nation for traumatic brain. Retraining of individuals have helped that. But there needs to be a continuing approach to this. Our commission spent an enormous amount of time in this area. As I said, we worked for 30 months, and PTSD and traumatic brain filtered in and out of nearly everything that we were involved in. We felt, and through the Institute of Medicine, we concluded that a standard testing system needs to be in place. A better understanding of and identifying of young men and women coming back from overseas, early intervention could help solve this, along with re-examinations. We recommended re-examinations for those that have been identified, not to take them out of the system, but to be able to identify, is the system working for them? Are we providing the proper treatment? Are we giving them a better chance to become a well veteran? With that, sir, I'd like to close and take any questions if necessary. But thank you very much again for having us here.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We really appreciate and the work you were doing on that as well. And that just would say some of the post-traumatic stress, you take people from a normal life and they're in horrendous combat, and how, you know, to make that so they understand that they should be upset about that, that that's, you know, their normal human reaction. You should be suffering from just seeing all the carnage you see. I know different people have different plans. Again, I don't want to pick on Representative Scott, but he volunteered for Naval service during Vietnam. He ended up being a corpsman working with the Marines quite a bit, and he's probably seen more horrendous things than I don't know about anybody in the room, but most of us in the room. So somebody like him would really understand this even better than Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Scott, for your service. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. And you too, Colonel. My question here, I guess, is when I listen to the good chair talk, is that, okay, so you said what we have been diagnosing as post-traumatic syndrome actually is some kind of brain traumatic injury due to what, standing next to an explosion or something and not being diagnosed properly? Is that what you're saying here?
Yes, sir. What I'm saying, I'm not saying all PTSD. We have misdiagnosed, especially currently, many young men and women calling it PTSD, and as the study has evolved with the traumatic brain injury, and the medical community has become more aware of that, they have gone back and reassessed some of these individuals and identified that some were misdiagnosed as PTSD, which were actually brain injury, severe concussions.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, we're put into one category where some treatment could have been available to them, and we are proving that we're able to. It's like teaching somebody with dyslexia. you can teach them to read even though they see the letters backwards. You know, and with proper training, they're starting to find that traumatic brain can be addressed and bring those people back into a more productive way of life. But no, not all PTSD is traumatic brain. PTSD has a criterion that identifies that. It's usually in a traumatic issue, i.e. witnessing death, being near death themselves, or... Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Just follow up and clarify for myself. Yeah, I that's not what I was... That's not what I thought you were saying in the first place. But so the problem is we're treating someone for... post-traumatic syndrome, when in reality we should be treating them for a brain injury, and the two treatments are totally different. And one, if you do use this treatment, it's ineffective for this.
That could be very
circumstance.
Yes, sir. Right. That could
okay.
be very.
Okay, I got you. Thank you.
Okay, we've seen the. I mean, just even the news accounts of the severe concussions, and I've seen people who've been injured in. Say industrial accidents where they've suffered some brain injury like that, and just the next time you see them, I mean, as they're recovered, they're just totally different person. Personality is different. I watch their marriages disintegrate and so on.
We have people, sometimes it's hard to identify the traumatic brain injury. A close relative, a wife, a spouse, will come back and say, this person isn't the same person that left here. We, going back and researching and doing study on the individual, find that they were either in close proximity to or involved in an explosion. One of the issues that's coming about now is the blast effect that is just now being studied. They're realizing that a severe blast close to somebody, the blast doesn't go around you, it goes through you. And IOM is doing studies on that today, and we're trying to determine what those blast effects are going to cause people with internal injuries that are not apparent today but may come down the road. Because of the types of equipment that we have today, the things we're trying to do for young men and women in the combat zone, the protective equipment, the armor, and everything else, we're seeing injuries return from the current conflict that would not have even returned from Vietnam.
Yeah.
And we know that during the Vietnam era, how we talked about injuries were coming home from Vietnam that would not have out of World War II or Korea. So we are now seeing more severe injuries coming home. We're still not sure of, this medical community is still not sure of how the blast effects, traumatic brain, and PTSD, which are the two major signature injuries coming out of the current conflict.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just as a kind of an addition to this, Colonel Brown and I, as we were having a discussion prior to this hearing, we talked a little bit about sometimes, you know, you don't recognize the symptoms or, you know, the diagnosis for PTSD or traumatic brain injury sometimes comes months or even years later. It's difficult for a veteran to say, I think I have traumatic brain injury, when they don't know that they have that. They may not even recognize that they are different. It may be the spouse or somebody who recognizes that. And with the post-traumatic stress, one of the interesting things is that sometimes that doesn't really manifest until later on, and it can be something that triggers. So they may be going along fine for quite some time, and then something triggers that PTSD. And so it's something that we're going to be seeing and hearing more about. And appreciate that Colonel Brown was able to be here. And we're not related, by the way, if anybody was wondering. Or married.
About 10 or 15 years ago, I was visiting with a friend of mine who was a World War II veteran who'd actually fought and been captured on Corregidor and spent World War II, most of it in Japan, in a prisoner of war camp and so on. And we were talking, and we were in Beaverton, and there's a big loud bang from a truck, and this guy hit the ground. That was the first time that had ever happened, but it all came back, and he was subsequently treated. He didn't, you know, he thought he was past all that, and it turns out he really wasn't. And that had been you know, many, many years before President Shoffman.
Thank you. Yeah, the more you learn about it, I'm not a doctor by any stretch of imagination, but this kind of information and data has to be directly related to what Dr. Cohn and the presenters earlier were talking about, and related to that suicide rate. I can't imagine it isn't directly related somehow.
The studies are showing that there is probably some relationship there. We're identifying that PTSD sufferers or traumatic brain injury, now that it's starting to come up, are showing that those personnel have a lower standard of life and also income earning over a lifetime after that, even before they are diagnosed. Those are critical issues. The guard is, and it depends on the state. Oregon is, we're very lucky. Oregon's been very aggressive on how we're approaching our young men and women as they return, also prior to departing and returning. Not every state is that way. We were held up occasionally in front of the commission as being an aggressive approach to what is going on for our veterans, especially the reservists and National Guard members as they go overseas and return, what's being provided for them. And for that, Oregon should be fairly thankful. Their veterans leaving here and coming back, be thankful for what the state is doing for them, because you are on the leading group recognized throughout the nation of taking an approach to this.
And I think we really have our Oregon Department, military department, to really thank for a lot of the effort they put out to get that in place, and General Caldwell and so on, and other people.
One of the things I'd like to close with, and Representative Scott, being a corpsman, my wife was an Army nurse in Vietnam. Same time I was flying over there as a scout reconnaissance pilot. On a regular basis, in fact, one day she was with us in the field and watched me get shot down. You know, now, there's a stressor that she wasn't in the combat, but then, you know, 4.5 hours later before I was picked up, she was going through an issue of had we survived. And as a pre-op and recovery room nurse at the 24th of Back Hospital, I walked in the evening at that hospital at times and found her with two corpsmen, our medics, on the ward with as many as 50 injuries. And they were doing such things as triage and identifying which ones could go into surgery immediately, which ones would be left or put behind the curtain, and if once everything was done, if they were still alive. Now, that is a stressor on people that you would say to begin with, they're not seeing combat, but they're seeing what combat does do. And they're making life and death decisions at that point. There are medical people that suffer from this. So it's not just because of the individual that was out with the rifle on the front line, especially in today's environment where convoys are being hit, units or personnel moving up and down the road, IEDs. It's a much more of a stressor than it was in our era in Vietnam. Thank you very much.
They're not here yet, so we'll go ahead and break for lunch.
You want to ask anyone from the audience?
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on any of these issues? Please.
Chair Bacher and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Weber, and I'm a citizen, I guess, and I live in South Salem.
And a former
state senator. Yeah. Long time ago. And I'm here just very, very briefly to add a little bit of personal touch, perhaps, or color to this whole topic. I was 2 years old when my father came home from World War II. 2 years later, he killed himself. In those days, no one ever talked about suicide, and it's only been in the last year and perhaps even in the last 3 weeks that I've been able to find out a little more. And one of the things I know, I just went back to a reunion of the veterans of the Battle of the Bulge, which my father fought in. And I think the 5 days I spent with those men, it was absolutely an incredible experience. One of the things that I came away from was, although there's a lot of discussion about family structure and people who kill themselves perhaps are not as strong emotionally as other people, I believe that after talking with them, my father killed himself because he went into the service. He was taught to kill. He killed. He came home. And I think we have to make sure that we understand that that is part of the war effort. Another issue for me, because of suicide, and I'm not sure what the status of it is today, but because he committed suicide, he was never recognized as a veteran. His name was not, or is a veteran killed in war, or a veteran who died as a result of the war. So my father's memory is not what it could have been. I see him as a hero, a man who went to war, who fought for his country, and came home and became in many ways a villain. Families, there's a lot of collateral damage. My family was, I had two younger sisters. My family was on welfare for a short time. There were never any veterans benefits available because the death was, quote, not service connected. And in thinking about this, one of the things I think that people I never realized is it's very, very important if you have a standing army, you have to have people willing and ready to kill. And once you get into having to do that, the idea of giving support historically, there's a wonderful book called Flashback, which goes back and talks about the history of suicide among veterans back to the Civil War. And it's only today that we're starting to recognize that soldiers in combat have emotional reactions to the combat. But in the Civil War and probably up through the Second World War, if men were seen as being emotional or not being able to handle the killing that they did or the killing that they saw, sometimes they were even shot. And there's some records and indication. The reason for that was that the Army had to maintain its standing military, and by denying the horrors of war, it helped the ability of soldiers to be able in the Army to continue to fight. And I would just like to say very much thank you, Chair Barker, and committee members for taking on this very, very important and very, very serious topic. It's way, way overdue. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming in and putting a little personal face on this. And I just was, remember during when the Vietnam thing was going on, the first people started, the veterans were complaining, some of the people coming back. And I remember seeing where there was a Korean vet who said, "That's not how you do it. You shut up and you go back to work, and you know, you go do that and come home and you get, you know, forget about all that, just get going again." And not everybody can do that.
Sure, Catherine and I are friends, and we were talking about this because my dad fought in the Bulge too. But you were telling me that your dad was the only survivor of his infantry platoon.
Yes, yes, he was. There were, I think, 11 men that belong in a company, or 12 men, and the other 11 men were killed. So I think the survival guilt, and he killed himself on the anniversary of that event, which was over Christmas vacation. Yes. And I would also like to say I'm now a retired state employee, and if there's any way or anything I can do to help your committee work, I have volunteer time and friends available that would like to be involved in an effort.
Well, thank you. We'll call it right. Later on then.
Thank you very much.
We already had a schedule, and the last item today, which is scheduled for 2 o'clock, is reintegration in the community. And part of that is people from Tri-West Healthcare who are not here yet, and we're trying to get a hold of them to come earlier. So what I think we'll do, do we have, Pat, do we have any estimate time when they might be here?
I've been talking to General Caldwell, and he thinks that the latest they'll be here is at 1:30. We're going to shoot, I think, for 1. We're trying to reach them right now.
What I'm going to do then is recess the committee for lunch until 1 o'clock, and then hopefully they'll be here. And since we scheduled them, we'd like to have them here for that. Committee on Veterans Affairs back to order, and thank you once again for everybody being here today. And just a reminder to be sure and shut off your cell phones and Blackberries. I forgot to tell Representative Scott that this morning. So next on the agenda is reintegration in the community, including providing health care to returning veterans and their families, and again General Caldwell and Mr. Evans and Troy West Healthcare. In no particular order. Okay. Pull another chair up, or if you need it, or and thank you for coming in a little early on such short notice. Too.
No, appreciate
that. A problem.
We want him centered up so you can really get all the damage.
You guys can jab him if he's saying something you don't want to hear. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, the Deputy Director at the Reagan Military Department, and. And I, as we were discussing with your able committee administrator earlier on about how we would want to present things to you, I thought it was important that we bring in our guest in the center here between Mr. Evans and I, which is Mike Hanley from Tri-West Corporation, who actually runs from TRICARE. TRICARE administers the TRICARE programs here for Oregon. As you recall, your committee, Mr. Chairman, last session was instrumental in producing the piece of legislation that subsequently went on to the Ways and Means and the Tax Guys of the Revenue Committee to put together a tax break for physicians or medical care providers. One of the great struggles that we've had in Oregon, and Mike can explain it better than I can, I'll give it to you from our perspective, is we've not been able to get enough providers to sign up under the government health care program for our soldiers and their families. TRICARE basically has been around now, what, about 5 years now? almost 12. Okay, well, it used to be, what, CHAMPUS, I guess it was. And previously, the CHAMPUS system was strictly for active guard reservists or federal active duty people that were assigned here in Oregon. And as you well know, we don't have any major military bases here, federal bases. So what you end up with is you end up with no real medical services in the state of Oregon, whereas if you're at Fort Lewis or you're in the state of Washington, you got Fort Lewis, you got McCord, you got Fairchild Air Base, you got the Navy, you got all these major medical facilities that serving members of the military. Well, here in Oregon, we don't, so it has to rely on the civilian medical population to provide coverage. Unfortunately, those rates to the civilians are tied directly to the Medicare and Medicaid costs. So whatever your state has been designated by Medicare and Medicaid for a particular tonsillectomy or appendicitis, whatever that rate is, that's what you get for TRICARE. So there's not a great incentive by the physicians. As you well know, Oregon is one of the lower states in Medicare reimbursement rates by some magic formula that I don't have the knowledge of, but it's certainly detrimental to the physicians here in this state from what they tell us. So they're not eager, from a business standpoint, to jump in and start taking on more of the already got Medicare, Medicaid. Now we flood the system with soldiers and their families. So we came to this body. We asked for a tax break for medical providers. It was established at $2,500. Came into effect, I think it was emergency clause. It was right when it was passed. I don't know. I'm real curious to hear from Mike here in just a second, as I know you are, to find out what if that's helped at all. But I also want to make sure you're aware that the federal government changed the rules, and they expanded TRICARE to drilling guardsmen and reservists. So it's no longer just those soldiers that have been activated in their families. or the full-time soldiers that we had before, which was roughly around 3,000 in this state. Now you've got the potential for, in the Oregon National Guard, 8,000 guardsmen and their families. And that could be the, and I suspect it could, with retirees, and Michael probably can give you a number of what that would be, you know, you're probably talking in the neighborhood of 15,000 to 20,000 different patients in this state. And they're all starting to push on that system and push it hard. And so it's certainly it's a great opportunity for our, and a great benefit, I believe, for guardsmen and reservists to have this for their families and them. It's not 100% free as if you're on active duty. When you're on active duty, you get it. If you're in the Guard or Reserve on regular guard duty or reserve duty, you have to pay a stipend. I think it's what, $600 a year. Yeah, $600 a year, which is a good deal for a young family that doesn't have any other means to do it. And we've tried to encourage employers to look at that and say, maybe you ought to pick that up, hire our guys when they come home, pick that $600 up, and now you've got a competitive advantage where you can provide health care for guard and reservists. Maybe you share that with that employee. So we've been trying to work that angle too. So that's kind of the ramp up, the prelude, and I'll unless Paul, you want to add something before Mike talks? Okay, and then we'll just let Mike kind of brief you up on where we're at now that I've set the stage for you. I hope you're ready.
My name is Mike Hamry, and again, I work for TriWest Healthcare Alliance, and we're one of three managed care support contractors in the United States, and the United States is carved up into three sort of large chunks. HealthNet Federal Services has the North, Northeast. Humana Military Healthcare has the South and Southeast, and TriWest Healthcare Alliance has the Western 21 states, to include Alaska and Hawaii. Those states are divided up into service areas, 15 of them, and each service area has a director. And so I'm one of those 15. My area is all of Oregon, all of Washington outside of the Puget Sound, and northern Idaho. And like General Caldwell said, the one portion of my service area that really emulates probably the majority of the rest of the program is it's Fairchild Air Force Base in Washington, where you have a military base, you have a military treatment facility, it's a primary care clinic, and then we as a contractor provide the civilian network that surrounds that, that they refer out to for their hospital and specialty care. Well, in Oregon, it's one of four states in the country that has no military treatment facility. We additionally build a civilian provider network and designated areas for the military service members or family members, retirees and family members. And so it's a little bit different in that it really, TRICARE, a lot of people refer to it as a my health insurance program, and TRICARE is not a health insurance program. TRICARE is a government entitlement program, more akin to Medicare than to maybe, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield or one of the commercial plans. What we do is we take a government entitlement program that's really kind of focused and structured to support a military treatment facility and turn it into a quasi-commercial health care plan. It's very transparent to them with our network of civilian providers. As General Caldwell said, there are some things that we do. We do have a fairly robust network. We have approximately 8,000 providers, contracted providers. There are a number of providers that we have, probably half or double that, that are not contracted that will see our patients. But the goal, we try to achieve is to try to have as many contracted providers because it's less out of pocket costs for retirees and for active duty family members. The things that we utilize to try to entice or convince providers to be a part of our network, one is patriotism. We indicate that these are folks that either are serving or have served their country. We utilize good customer service. We have an excellent network of provider representatives that reach out and touch and work with these providers. And the other thing is fast claims payment. The TRICARE program probably has one of the quickest, fastest claims payment rates in the country. I talked to senior executives from other commercial health care plans, and one of the first things they say is, I wished we could take and pay claims as quickly as TRICARE does. So we get the money to them quickly, and we make sure that they have good customer service. The other thing that they like about TRICARE that other companies don't do is we also have a very aggressive education program. Spend a lot of time out. We have representatives out going to various locations, speaking to retiree groups, speaking to the military groups, and educating people on their TRICARE benefits. And the providers really like that because folks that belong to commercial health care plans, they come in, they have to spend quite a bit of time explaining to them, first of all, what their benefits are, and then providing their care. And with most of the TRICARE beneficiaries, they're already educated. They come in, they can provide their care, and they can move on to the next patient, and they appreciate it. In discussions with the providers, the major issue is reimbursement. We have a lot of providers that will take a certain amount of TRICARE patients. There's some kind of magic number for them business-wise is the best mix. It could be 200, 500. When they reach that point, they're contracted, but they'll close off their practice and say, okay, I've got 300 TRICARE patients, and I'll keep the ones that I have, but please don't assign any new ones to me. So one of the things that we're always looking for is, you know, additional primary care providers. And again, when I speak with them and our reps speak with them, typically the biggest issue is reimbursement. That if TRICARE reimbursed more, then I think that we have a much higher participation rate. Not that what we have currently is not good. It's actually, given the circumstances, we actually have a fairly robust network. We try to capitalize on every opportunity that we can, because we want to try to provide the best care, you know, that we can for the service members and families. There's a number of things that we do, especially in conjunction with the Garden Reserve that our company is taking on. Behavioral health is, as been discussed very, very heavily today, is something that's very key for our company. And I provided each of you a few pieces of information that our company has been distributing to basically hundreds of thousands of copies to military service members and family members. The first is a Health from Home DVD. These are interviews of service members and family members that have come back from deployment, basically discussing things like PTSD, suicide, those kinds of things, the impact that it had on their family, and basically encourage them to go get the help and assistance that they need and where to find it. And so this is, I think we probably sent out or distributed close to 500,000 copies of these nationwide. Very, very popular. Along with that, we also have a brochure that we pass out and distribute that also goes over some of those things. And the main thing is letting them know what resources are available or how to recognize the symptoms. And so one of the things on our website, TriWest.com, is we have a very extensive behavioral health web portal where you can actually go and find out information if you're a provider, if you're a beneficiary, if you're a service member or a unit commander, and you can check each one of those, and there's a whole bunch of resources and such that people can tap into. The greatest resource is the fact that they can actually tap in and find out who the local behavioral health providers are in their community if they need to go see somebody. So that's been something that we've received some really good reviews on and comments. The other is just recently updated our National Guard and Reserve web portal. Has an extensive amount of information on there specifically tailored to Guard and Reserve members to include some of the behavioral health. The other thing that they can do is we have a number of different types of TRICARE presentations that we do for different types of people, service members, retirees, and one of the nice things about this is they can actually click on the type of briefing that they would like to watch and actually get a full TRICARE briefing, just as if they were going to one of our locations or their unit location from one of the representatives. So if you live out in Baker City or Union or someplace like that, you can actually tap on and actually get the same quality briefing that you get if you travel to Salem or to Portland to get it. So there's some significant things that are happening there. The two things that are really prevalent, again, in the behavioral health arena is coordinating and working with the Veterans Administration, because they seem see a lot of those patients, and so working very hard to make sure that there's a good communication link between ourselves and the VA and then local providers that are providing the care. One of the things that is going to be happening on the 4th and 5th of December is we're partnering with our TRICARE regional office out of San Diego, and we're actually having the first TBI and behavioral health conference in Tacoma, specifically to gather all the points of contact to specifically talk about how is the best way to handle these folks and make sure that nobody slips through the crack. A little bit more unique in that if you've got somebody who's dealing with some issues and at Madigan and they want to get them home, if they send them to Fairchild Air Force Base, there's a military clinic, there's a Spokane VA, and there's also a very robust civilian network there that can provide that care. But one of the things that is a challenge is that some of these folks require very specialized care. And so if you're going to, and obviously the goal is to get these folks back with their families during their recuperation period. And so if they, to try to take and send somebody to maybe Bend or to LeGrand or to Ontario, you know, the big issue is the specialty care there available for them to get it? And so one of the things that they're working on is to try to develop that communication to make sure that these folks are getting the care that they need and it's available for them where they need to get it.
Thank you. I want to go back to this reimbursement concept. It's a big problem here in Oregon. My wife's a dentist, and she doesn't accept certain entitlement programs because of the little amount of money she's reimbursed. Now, if she did accept them, she'd have to shorten the length of time she applied to whatever procedure that is on that patient in order to make money. Well, now you're in a hurry, and then what are you going to get? And she doesn't get in a hurry, and she's really good at what she does, as much as she would. She does a lot of volunteer work, you know, screening kids at schools for sealants and things like that. But, and I think she's as patriotic as the next American is, because we live the life of Riley in this country, to be quite frank with you, because of the work these men and women are doing defending this country. But the reimbursement rate for this state relative to others, I forget how many hundreds of millions of dollars we're literally being shorted relative to a lot of states. If we could get that to be more equitable, we could provide a higher reimbursement rate and I'm sure get more providers to get on board here. Now, I'm not an expert in healthcare. As a matter of fact, I'd much rather talk about cutting down trees and milling lumber and building industry, the easy subjects, but I really think we need to bang on this drum, and whether it's from healthcare advocates or veterans advocates, whatever, it all adds up. So I share your pain, I guess. I just don't know what our federal delegation is doing, if anything, if they can do anything. But I hope you all are hammering on them, saying we want to get our money's worth out of this, because I believe Oregon does. Don't we have a disproportionate number per capita of men and women in the military and serving? Is that true, or is it just the rural parts of Oregon that are disproportionate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffer, I don't know that's a fact. I know that. Yeah, we could probably do those numbers, and there's probably some statistician somewhere that has that, but we have a fairly high number.
Right.
I don't know if it's the highest, but I'd say we're probably in the top half for sure. Back to your reimbursement question, we have had conversations over the last 5 years when we first recognized this as an issue, trying to get providers, because they're business people, they've got to make a living. Mm-hmm. We have asked Representative Hooley, and she has sponsored in every congressional session since then, a bill that basically says that TRICARE would get the highest rate nationwide. Whatever that Medicare or Medicaid reimbursement rate is, then TRICARE patients, regardless of where they are in the United States, would be able to get that higher rate. So we're not pitted against that problem that we have, which many, I've talked to several physicians, and they've all said virtually the same thing. You know, I mean, we simply cannot, if our practice is Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE, we're out of business. We just can't stay in business. And so it isn't that they don't want to do the service, and many of them serve now under what Mike explained as the non-contracted provider, but then that leaves a bill for the patient. That leaves a bill for the soldier. And that isn't the objective. It certainly is. For example, I don't know if it's changed now, but a year ago, there was one OBGYN contracted with TRICARE in the state of Oregon. It was here in Salem, if I remember correctly. Now, maybe there's more now, but that creates a significant issue. Now, Representative Hooley is still trying to work it. The delegation, I know, is behind her. But it's a matter of cost. I mean, it's going to cost more, and they've got to figure out a way to pay for it. So I don't think it's lost on them. I think it's just a simple fact that it's going to take continual pushing and grinding, and I know she's supported it wholeheartedly, but we're going to have to get more people involved in it, I think, nationwide to get get that energy behind it to get it through. And that would make a significant difference if we were able to do that. I think then suddenly TRICARE patients would be preferred. Now, we also have one example here in Salem with our former state surgeon, Dr. Lassen, who set up a practice, or his practice, he's had a practice for years here in town, but he went to physician's assistants, and I think he's got three, is that right? Two. He's got two physician's assistants and himself, and he's pretty much exclusively TRICARE, Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE. And he believes that business model, he's not getting rich, but he said, I'm paying the bills, making 11, and he said it's working so far. Now, he's been in it for about a year now, I think, just in 1 year. Now, I know Mike's been involved with his company in trying to promote that business model to other places inside their company, as well as nationally, but certainly here in Oregon. Now, I don't know if any more popped up with that same business model or not, but
not yet.
But we are promoting that, and again, this has been a godsend for the. And we have a heavy concentration of soldiers in the Oregon Guard between Eugene and Portland. That's the population base, and that's where we have a great deal of our soldiers and airmen. So in that sense, I think that's a positive thing for our local area. But it still doesn't solve that problem in the rural areas, as he indicated.
Mr. Chair, I really have to say this, if I may. You know, I read the paper like everybody else, and the first projections, they were poo-pooed by the Vice President and others of $100, $125 billion on this war. They said, no, it isn't going to be that much. Now we seem to be able to magically find endless amounts of money to be poured into this. And if this is not part of a line item on that budget, well, it's criminal. I mean, if we cannot provide health care for the men when we come back here, along with a long list of other things we've talked about here today, inside those incredibly huge budgets, you know, we're really letting America down. That's my humble opinion.
I might just recommend that maybe that's something this committee would want to take on as a resolution to send, maybe pop out in February and send on to our congressional delegation to support this very activity. As again, Representative Hooley's certainly been out there leading the way in this for the country, as far as I'm concerned, but it's just getting other people to help her.
Mr. Chair, my name is, for the record, Paul Evans. I'm policy advisor for Governor Kungoski. I'd like to respond to Representative Schaffler's point. Really, there's a couple of pieces in this, and I'm not a very smart guy, so I got to deal with numbers that I can point to. Congressional research suggests that $610 billion has been appropriated above static costs for Department of Defense activities, meaning $610 billion since 2001 for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of that $610 billion, $450 has been appropriated for Iraq. Of the $610 billion, less than $5 billion has been added on as veterans, basically has been added on or appropriated for specific veterans' concerns. There's really, what those numbers mean to me are really two pieces. One, with the transition of the National Guard and Reserve from a strategic reserve to an operational reserve, this problem isn't going away as soon as the war is over. That's the first thing. So we've got to find a way to make the TRICARE system work. We've got to find a way to make it palatable for docs and others to be able to treat and keep our force healthy. That's just a fact. We have to find a way to do that. The other piece is, through the National Guard Association, I know that there has been some conversations about this. But ultimately, where I actually think the most powerful, potent pivot on this is the National Conference of State Legislators. Because ultimately, the Congress will have to make a giant policy decision to change the reimbursement rates. That's not a D thing, that's not an R thing, but it is a local thing. And actually, legislators, I think, through the National Conference of State Legislators, can play a significant role on that. So, I mean, it's one of those things that is so big it's going to take all hands to make it work. But it has a local impact. And your question earlier, sir, about, you know, is Oregon proportionately more soldiers than not? The reason it looks different in Oregon is because we are one of the four states without a major military installation. So a lot of our folks that are in the fight
are our neighbors. They're guardsmen, they're reservists. So it has a much larger impact, I think, in the communities than if we were military towns.
Where does the reimbursement rate fall? Is it the same as, less than, more than Medicare?
It depends on the service. There are some services where TRICARE pays slightly more than Medicare, and there are some Medicare services that are reimbursed higher. But on the average, they're pretty much the same.
Okay, thanks.
I did want to make a statement. We do have more than one OB provider in the state of Oregon.
That's good.
that was open and accepting patients at the time. We have close to 350 to 400.
And another thing that I thought about as we were talking about this, and it's going to be a cost shifting onto the states, is the people, the so-called contractors, Blackwater, and those people are not covered under the military because they're independent, but they're going to come back, and a lot of those people are going to be needing services that we're going to end up getting stuck with. I don't get too philosophical about while the profits are going somewhere else, and now they've opened an offshore I assume to avoid paying taxes, called Greystone, that same outfit, and they moved it down to the, I can't remember which rail drop they're using in the Caribbean, but those kind of things are going to cost this country a lot, too, that are kind of hidden costs of this war, but we certainly need to take care of our men and women who are going over there for $30,000 or $40,000 a year, not $600 a day, and coming back to be with us, so...
Mr. Henley, maybe you answered this question. The General Caldwell mentioned a tax credit of $2,500 for the purposes of attracting people into your system. Has it done that?
Thanks for bringing it. I was going to come back to that point. It has a little bit. We have seen some increase. It was signed by the governor in late July. We're working very closely with the Oregon Department of Rural Health, gathering the numbers of folks, and the rules for that program are actually being established and are supposed to be released by the Rural Health Department probably within the next few weeks. So we're going to be working together with them. This is for, if I'm not mistaken, beginning in tax year 2008 or 2007.
It was 2007.
So, I mean, we've gotten some good publicity, but also we're still, you know, working with some of the associations and folks to get the word out. There's still a decent amount of providers that have not heard about it, and especially where it takes a little bit longer to travel, maybe sometimes to the rural areas, which is where we really would like to see the impact. So right now, currently, it's still relatively new. We haven't seen a huge tidal wave, but I believe as the word gets out and the rules get established, And the providers have an opportunity to see how that will actually work. We're hoping to really do some very good marketing efforts and try to get that word out to them.
Great.
Any questions?
Thanks.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I might just add on to that. Maybe perhaps in December when we have another meeting or another hearing, that might be a good opportunity to get both Mike and the Rural Health Administrator in here and really drill down on that and see what the numbers look like and how we're doing. And if nothing else, maybe it'll provide a little publicity, additional publicity, that will help get the word out even further. So I would recommend maybe we put that down as an agenda item for our next meeting as well.
Maybe... Paul, you can take it back to your boss. Maybe he can do an ad or something that would announce that, and do a TV ad or something where he could get out the word.
Well, we'll certainly take that back to the boss. Mm-hmm. I know we're wrapping up on this phase of this hearing, but I would just add that we've had an excellent relationship with TriWest. TriWest has been a godsend compared to what we used to deal with, which was Champus. And Champus, unfortunately, got a terribly bad name with many of the providers in this state, and it became, they would run out of money in May in the budget, and they would have bills to pay that they legitimately, by law, needed to pay, and they just wouldn't pay them until October when they got another budget. And many of the medical providers just said, I'm not going to deal with it. I think one of the numbers that Mike gave me here some time back was, I think you were in the 98 or 99 percentile of getting bills paid within 30 days when they got it. And I mean, that was just unheard of. So we're still, and he said 12 years, I didn't realize it had been that long, we're still dealing with providers who want to talk about Champus and want to talk about how poor the pay was and how slow it was. Even today, and I suspect you deal with it as well. So we're very, very pleased with this provider. We've been extremely fond of the way that they have worked with us. We've set up an office here in Salem at our Anderson Readiness Center. In fact, we stole one of his employees. She was a very talented individual and knew both sides of it, so we stole her and hired her to help us deal with it. And we've originally set that out to be strictly for the Guard. It's turned out to be an all-services deal, retirees and everybody. So we're, in effect, doing all the different services, Guard, Reserve, active duty, former active duty, retirees, and it's truly turned into quite an operation. We started with one person. I think we're up to six that we've had to reschedule and put people in there just to handle the workload. And it's gotten so... We were scheduling people for appointments. I just read an email this morning that said we're no longer doing appointments because there's so many people coming in, walking through the door. Appointments just aren't working. If you've got them, we'll honor them. But we're getting rid of the appointment thing. It's first come, first serve. Because there's a constant, steady stream of retirees, veterans, current serving active duty people from other services and our own, and plus our own people. So it's turned into quite a deal. We've had to do a lot of push around and move around, and we're building the bike while we ride it, literally. I mean, we are riding this bike, and we're putting pieces on it as we go to make it go down the stream. So.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just for the record, nothing I said was aimed at TriWest or TriCare. I mean, being married to a dentist, I'm well-versed in prompt reimbursement. She loves nothing more than that. I believe she gives a discount if you are prompt. My brother-in-law just retired from the Coast Guard, and he's on, I believe, doing TriWest, TriCare, which one you call it. And he likes it, so it's not aimed at you. Believe me, these doctors, and you do dental too and vision? Just medical? Either way, I mean, these folks are highly educated people and have invested a lot of money into their practices, believe me. And we have to reimburse them. Otherwise, they can't continue to do it, period. So we just need to get the federal government to recognize the fact that we're getting shorted. It's hundreds of millions of dollars a year, this reimbursement rate, not just for the military, but overall, that we're being shorted in the state relative to the rest of the country. And, well, hey, I want our piece of the action here. So that resolution idea, Mr. Chair, I'm up for that, whether it be in February or 09 or whenever we want to do it, but specifically aimed at veterans. But I think we should have one also aimed at the whole reimbursement program process.
The seniors are suffering under some of those same problems with Medicare, and especially the poor people with Medicaid, the reimbursements. And when I served several years on the Portland and police and fire disability and pension fund, and we would have a meeting once a month, but we had a subcommittee would meet every 2 weeks in the middle of that period so we could pay those bills promptly. And of course we paid at higher rates than Medicaid or whatever, but even when you're paying pretty much full price or whatever, still, if that isn't coming in regular, the providers suffer. So we made sure that we took care of it because we wanted our people being able to get access when they needed it. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the way I understand the rules for the supplemental session, each committee gets one bill. I would assume that a resolution would count as another bill. I would assume that General Caldwell would rather see the other bill go forward than the resolution. So I'm fully aware that every rule around here is an exception, but right now I don't know the exception. So.
Okay. Well, we'll certainly take a look at the resolution when we meet next time, and even if we have to wait until 09 to run it out, the fly.
Okay.
General Caldwell mentioned claims being paid. We have a contractual requirement that all claims are paid within 30 days.
That's great. Excellent.
And to give you just an idea, average turnaround time on an electronic claim that's submitted is 2 days, and average turnaround time for a paper claim submitted is 4. So we're very turning around very quickly. Also, as General Caldwell mentioned, I believe that Oregon is the only state National Guard headquarters that has its own organic TRICARE representative full-time. So again, it's a commitment that we've made to the military department to ensure that that any of those folks that do need the education, do need assistance with their claims, authorizations, referrals, whatever it takes to make sure that they have a smooth health care plan, and if it's the least disruption on them, we're making sure that we do that.
And I also think, just in looking at remembering the difference of time with Vietnam and so on, that this country did have some guilt over the way the troops were treated after Vietnam, and so this time they're not letting that happen. I mean, people are, you know, I've seen the numbers on people who support the war in Iraq. It's pretty low, but the people who support try to see to it that the men and women who are serving is very high, and that's good. They separate the policy, so we're not blaming somebody that's called up and really serving, and the sacrifice they're making is being highly valued this time around. I'm glad to see that come back. Anything further? Is there anybody in the audience would like to testify about any of this? Okay, thank you, Bill.
Mr. Chairman, we have one other piece that I wanted to talk to your able committee administrator about is giving a quick overview and just an update on what our reintegration team is doing. I've got Major Thompson here with me today, who's the new team leader, and I wanted him to have an opportunity to just tell you a little bit about what we have been doing here in the last since the session ended and tell you about some of the things we got planned.
Okay, great.
So if you'd indulge us to allow him to come forward, and with him is his able assistant, Sergeant Jocks, who's been one of our team leaders. He was actually one of the reasons why we started it, was because of Sergeant Jocks cornering me at an armory and telling me we were kind of screwed up. And so, thanks to Sergeant Jocks, we've got a reintegration team in this state that's become the model of this nation. So,
yeah.
So if I get them up here, I'd...
And thank you very much again for coming in.
Yeah. Not that unusual.
Thank you.
Yeah. As I said, as a way of introduction, Chaplain Thompson has served in Afghanistan, and you've been in Iraq too? Iraq and, yeah, right, 2162. And Sergeant Jocks, of course, is also an Iraqi veteran. And if you would kind of give us an update or give the committee an update on what we've been doing on reintegration, I think it'd be helpful.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Major Daniel Thompson. I serve as a chaplain in the Oregon Army National Guard. I just wanted to give you an overview of our activities. I gave you a copy of a typical call. This one came in yesterday. I think you have it in front of you. But here is at heart what the reintegration team does. We work really hard at building a network of care for our soldiers, both veterans and those that are still serving with us. And what we try to do is utilize the trust. Sergeant Jocks, myself, and some of us that have been deployed before have special relationships with these guys that have been deployed. And soldiers aren't really good at asking for help. So we try to take advantage of our ability to relate to these guys, spend time with them, visit them, and make those connections so that when they do get in trouble, they have someone they trust outside of the bureaucracy that they can trust. And then we really work hard to try to make that connection with them. So we've made several efforts at intentionally reaching out to our soldiers. Of course, we see them monthly, but not all of them, because some of them have since left military service, and so we try real hard to work reaching out to veterans and to those that are serving right now. A couple things, and I'll let Sergeant Jocks chime in here wherever he wants to, but we've been working hard at what we call Soldier Enhancement Days. In fact, we have a really big event. Sergeant Jocks, why don't you tell them what's happening on the 3rd of November?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Sergeant First Class Jocks. I'm one of the NCOs on the reintegration team. I operate as a reintegration area manager. These Veterans Career and Benefits Fairs are really one of the neatest things we've set up. I can answer my phone. We answer our phone 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There is a line. We get that to the units. There's not a lot you can do after 8 or 9 o'clock at night except develop a plan with them. And then see it through the next day when they're ready to help themselves. But going into the Veterans Career and Benefits Fairs, it's like everything in one day. And instead of answering my phone 200 to 800 times, we can put that soldier right in front of the person that they need to see. They don't really need to see me unless they want to talk and develop a strategy to go out and be successful. We put them in front of the vet centers. We put them in front of the Roseburg VA, the OIF, OEF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom coordinator for the VA. We set them up there with them. White City, I don't know if I said Roseburg. And there's different little things that they cover that we're able to kind of shoot those guys to and let the leadership also know about these assets that are out in the communities. Then the VFW, American Legion, Military Order of the Purple Heart, and vets, the list goes on with those. They stick up for us out in D.C., you know, when they're taking stuff away from us all the time, as you guys know. So they can become a member of one of those organizations that do stick up for us. And then rolls into all the career opportunities that are out there for us right now. And it's not just us. We have Vietnam vets coming in there. We help out, you know, the most elderly veteran we've helped out is actually Sergeant Heyer, who's on the team, helped out Bill Wingett, one of the Band of Brothers here in town, with his VA claim. So that was kind of a really neat thing. But the career opportunities are absolutely unbelievable. Sergeant Moss runs that program, the Career Transition Assistance Program. There's over, I believe at this time, over 174 employers that are out there that offer a family wage job with benefits. They've hired over 264 returning veterans with family wage employment. They've signed General Caldwell, an unbelievable memorandum of understanding with the apprenticeship program, which gives these guys a straight shot to be a plumber, steam fitter, pipe fitter, mason, carpenter, heavy equipment operator, the list goes on.
Laborer.
You know, just anything out there. And another thing that these Veterans Career and Benefits things, or one of our deals that they really do, is that all these organizations, some of them kind of overlap. They offer things that are very similar to the other one. They're able to network with each other and help each other out, help these soldiers out. And there's, like, even down in Medford, there was people that were organizations we were dealing with that were doing very similar things, and they were networking with each other to go, hey, this is what we can do for them here. Oh, yeah, we got housing over here, too, that we can push them in and get them back on their feet so they can be successful out there. And that's what all these guys want. They had this tremendous amount of responsibility there. That's how I feel, is, you know, people's lives were on your shoulders. And it's very difficult to leave that behind. So if you dump a lot of stuff on them, they love it. I know I like it when the world's riding on my shoulders. That's when I'm happy. And that's how the soldiers that I familiar or stick around, that's how they feel. The guys out of my old platoon, old battalion, they're just great group of guys. I can't say enough about them. The next career and benefits fair we're doing is up at Clackamas Community College, and this thing is unbelievable. Shelly Perini has set this thing up. She's kind of led the way. We've just been holding on, trying to keep up with her. It's going to be held at Clackamas Community College on the 3rd. It'll go from 9 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. They've got the meals covered. There's going to be right around 30 service organizations, and I believe at this time they're sitting at over 40 career opportunities, and that's what we normally sit at with these. And it's going to be amazing. And it's open to everyone in the community. We're not just doing this for the soldiers that are in the Oregon Guard. There's a lot of veterans out there walking on the streets right now. They got, for the most part, dumped on their head, and they're kind of flailing out there off active duty. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard, and the reserves. We don't let that happen to our guys as much as we can. There are going to be people that slip through the cracks because we're not perfect. Trust me, I'm not perfect. But we're trying to get out there to them. And it's really it's an amazing thing to be the only state that's really, really actively doing that. And I invite all of the whole team, on behalf of us, we'd like to see you guys show up to this and see what they're all about.
I'm going to be flying to China that morning, so I won't be able to be there.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, you've mentioned the building trades. I don't remember the average age of the building trades worker, but it's pretty far up there. And this country needs more people in the building trades. And a lot of that work is not for the squeamish. It needs people that are going to come to work every day, ready, prepared to work, and they aren't afraid to take on big tasks. And it's a perfect fit for the men and women in our military, and we're hiring more state police in this state. That's the military is a perfect source for that. So I think there are, it's just making that connection of that individual with that job, whatever it might be. And I'm grateful for all your efforts and anything I can do or we can do to help you, because it's just a great source of labor out there, and to let it slide by would be a huge mistake.
The state police at the Medford event that we just did, they got 25 applications. They were definitely invited. And then over in Klamath Falls, I believe they had 20 applications, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. And they were quality guys just mm-hmm. coming back. So, and we bring them in. And if you have any ideas of people that we're missing, we got a little spreadsheet and whatnot. Let us know. We'll bring them in.
There's, you know, a big employer in Portland is Gunderson Brothers, although it's a different... Green Lake, I think, is the overall company, but that's a good construction job. They're non-union, but they would love to have some of your drug-free applicants come out, because I've talked to them, and one of their problems is getting people to pass that test to come to work, and they have I would believe good manufacturing career opportunities there, and they, you know, good pay, decent family pay, and they have good benefits and so on there. So that would be somebody else you might contact. They hire or have a working staff around 900 people there, and they're always looking for new.
Mr. Chairman, I have had a conversation with Mr. Furman, who's the CEO, and he is definitely exactly that very thing you just said. He said, I need people. I can train them how to do the job. He said, but I need them that they'll show up to work on time.
Right.
They'll be there every day, 5 days a week, and they're drug-free. And he said, if I can get that out of an individual, I can make them successful, and I'll pay them a decent wage. But he said, I can't find those kind of people.
Yeah, they're having difficulties.
And that's pretty much the message we hear from most employers.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to point out that Rep. Barker and I both met with Sergeant Heyer a month or so ago, and Mr. Mike, the general, he's great, and what he's doing is just incredible, and I hope that it extends to all. He's doing a thing with the community colleges, getting a veteran service resource center on these campuses, and they're going to open up the one in Lane pretty soon. But I think we've got 17 community colleges in our state, and if we can get something like that going at each one of those, they're all workforce oriented too. And then I'll put in a plug, because my good friend Rep. Shoffler appreciate this. In my district, we have a lot of timber companies, and they could use some good employees. And it's the same thing, just even down to the starting as a log truck driver or mill worker. You know, there's a lot of people could have these good jobs, their family wage jobs with benefits and retirement, etc. And getting people to be able to pass that drug test and be available for work. And I can't think of a better training area for learning how to be a great worker within the military. So somehow connect those dots, I think we could help a lot of guys.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, we are working with community colleges and Workforce Development Office, and okay. We're trying diligently to take Sergeant Heyer's idea with the Vet Center and expand that. We've had good receptions. In fact, this is the President's meeting this weekend over at Sun River, and we have a representative over there that is actually talking to him about that very thing.
And follow up, another employer you might try, we're hoping that this will cause them to get a little extra work, and that is Oregon Iron Works, and they're building the buoys for the wave projects out on the coast.
Mr. Chair, very briefly, I just wanted to thank the General for being wise enough to listen to a sergeant. We could use some of that wisdom in this building. There's a lot of people running around here think they're a general, and they ain't listening to anybody. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, it was. I happen to know Benny before he deployed, and not real well. We've never served together in the same unit, but He was wise enough to corner me at an event down in Eugene, pull me aside, and he was home basically recovering from his wounds while he was in Iraq. And he said, you know, we got a problem. Some of my buddies and I got problems, and we're not real sure where to deal with them. And it really did indicate to me that, you know, we had done a great job of pushing people out the door, getting them to in the deployments. That was our job. We'd never dealt with the aftermath of this before. We weren't designed to do it. We weren't manned to do it. We didn't really know who the players were. We knew that, you know, the Oregon Department of Veterans Administration could help us, but we really didn't know the game. We just weren't in it. And so the light went on, thanks to Vinny's prompting, and we started kind of slow, and I got to put a plug in for my commander-in-chief here, our Governor Kulongoski, because when we took our problem to his staff and to him, he said, whatever you need, I will get it for you. You tell me what you need. This program is unique in the sense that we have federal and state money mixed into this. We started it basically out of Hyde. And we took some money out of our maintenance budget and hired and moved some resources that we had and brought state employees and federal employees, put them together. And since Benny was being paid by the feds and he was home recovering, I said, I got a job for you. And then, what was that, 2 years ago? 3 years ago? And here about a year ago, and then I went and got one of my former executive officers who'd retired, and I said, I'm bringing you, come back and help me. And he did. That's Colonel McCray. And he's been extremely involved in the whole thing. In fact, he's going to receive the Governor's Gold Award here next month for his work after being retired. But had it not been for the Governor being the kind of man he is and his leadership in this thing and understanding it, it would have been a lot tougher. We'd have probably got it done, but he made it a little easier for us.
Another enlisted man.
Yeah, exactly. another enlisted man. Well, it helps.
Chair, as a former enlisted man myself in the National Guard, I just can't resist this question. And being the son of a former enlisted man in World War II, to the good sergeant, isn't it true sergeants really run the Army?
I'm supposed to ask him that tomorrow.
Well, I believe General Eisenhower had it pretty right. And he said, somebody asked him, what won World War II? And he said, the Buck Sergeant and the Sherman Tank. And I don't think things have changed very much.
Yeah.
I lean on the sergeants, those young sergeants in the Army now, team leaders and squad leaders. They're the one that are winning out there right now. And it doesn't sound like it's any different than any other thing that's ever happened.
One last thing. I'd like Chaplain Thompson to just mention just a little bit about what we're doing with some other groups that we're working with here locally on the TBI and the suicide issues.
Mr. Chairman, we just sat down yesterday with Oregon Partnership, and they are very excited to work with the military on the suicide prevention issue and access to counseling for our soldiers. So it's just another effort in that networking process. We have on the 29th, just this coming Monday, we're excited about a Portland VA summit. The city of Portland has stepped up and said we want to help. And so we're excited about that. And we're organizing that in such a way as all the resources there in Portland are coming together saying, how can we help soldiers? So we're not even running that event. We're just a part of it. But we feel the support, and we feel like there's a lot of people that care out there.
Yeah.
And so if we can work as a team, we'll get some things accomplished.
Right. Well, I can't resist. You know, you've said a lot of good things about our governor. I've just got to say, without his leadership and everything that he's done and the hard job that he has taken on upon himself to appear at all the funeral services for fallen soldiers, I know it meant a lot to the family in my district who's had a terrible aftermath in this and could use some of these services now after losing their husband and father. But the fact that the governor's behind this so strongly makes our job so easy, and that anything that we can get done, we've got his backing. So we're lucky.
Say something to that, too. It really hit me with the governor also. He was there at Ken Lyson's funeral right when I got... He was killed in action with me. The governor was there, and he, you know, he came up and said, hey, you know, if you need anything, let me know. I was like, holy smokes, this is my commander-in-chief.
saying this to me. And it was very humbling to me, and it meant the world to me, and I'll never forget it the rest of my life. And quite frankly, everyone on the team kind of thinks of this program kind of as the governor's program in a lot of ways, because he is the only guy, the only governor as far as I know, that's made it to all the funerals that he possibly can out of any other governor in the United States, as far as I know. And he's more involved with us than anybody. And it's just, we're, like you said, we're very fortunate to have him.
Yeah, thank you. The governor's always had my full support for being governor. It's no secret in here, I do not always agree with the governor. But I will tell you this, on these issues, he's been a champion. Willamette National Cemetery is right in the middle of my district. I've seen his car and processions go by several times. And God bless him for not forgetting his colleagues in the armed services. And, you know, it's like everything else in this building. You know, sometimes we get it right, sometimes we get it wrong. But on this one, the governor's got it squared away. And I just wanted to express that, because I like to give credit where credit's due and not just beat people up around here when I don't agree with them. So anyway, so that's what I wanted to throw in there. Thank you. But I really appreciate everything. This has been a great hearing today. I'm not a big fan of informational hearings. That's no secret either. But today really has been chock full of really vital, timely information that I believe we need to act on. So, and are acting on. So thank you very much.
And we appreciate it. And we have nothing else to report unless you have any other questions of us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And we'll probably have a meeting either in December or January. There'll be some kind of a deadline about getting things to legislative council to be drafted, and we'll be ahead of that deadline. Mr. Taylor will keep track of that, and we'll get notices out in plenty of time. And thank you, committee staff today. Patsy, thanks for help. With that, I'll adjourn the meeting, and thank you again, everybody, for your appearance today and your help.
Thank you.